This is the whole committee today. And get to work. Maybe we can get out before 5 today. We'll see. We're going to work session on HB 2648, which comes to us from the Access Subcommittee. Is that right? No.
No. That is just in the full
this
committee.
This goes here. Okay. In the full committee. Here's where we're going today. We've been working with pharma and some of the individual drug companies. We're working towards getting an agreement, which we think we might get by the middle of the week. What I would like to do today is,
this must be the one with the fat file. No.
There it is. I would like to adopt the dash one and the dash two amendments to the bill, and we will have amendments a week from Monday. We'll hear it again in the full committee. Remember, the full committee is going to meet on a week from Monday and 2 weeks from Monday, right?
Well, I have an answer.
Probably. We're probably going to meet both days. And we'll have a set of amendments to the amended bill at that point. Although if Ledge Council wants to, they could produce a dash three that covers everything. You can talk to them and we'll do it either way. Okay. So if I may have and I'm hoping that we'll come back with a bill without opposition when we meet next time. And we'll also know a little bit about whether there's going to be a fiscal when we come next time. Can I have a motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can we have somebody explain the amendments before we...
Okay, well, the dash ones aren't an amendment. They're basically a gut and stuff. And I'll...
Not quite.
Some big changes in it.
True.
Basically, what we're trying to do with the dash one amendments is make sure that we... produce a ban in law that's the equivalent of what pharma reported to us was their voluntary policy now. And it defines, basically it says you can't give any gifts except a certain number of things. Gifts that has educational benefit to the patient. We took into consideration what Mr. Gardner said the constitutional limits were about limiting free speech and put those kind of gifts back in. We talked about what meals can be provided. In fact, one of the changes we expect in the amendments that will come from pharma is an increase of that $25 meal to $100 because the problem of trying to find a meal in a in a hotel where they organize a meeting is, I heard somebody say recently, you go to organize a meeting and they say you want the $50 menu or the $75 menu, and that's basically the minimum. There's some problem about the bill restricts allowing guests of the physician to come. We may talk about other kinds of people, things like that. And there's what else? I think that's basically the change between the ones and where we are in the existing bill. The twos, the university has asked us to put in, and that allows them to, after residents, it says residents, fellows, or employees of Oregon Health Sciences University, as allowed by the conflict of interest policy of the university, and then allows them to a few more people to be invited than just residents. I think that's basically what the dash ones and the dash twos do. As I say, my intention, and I hope we will get the dash ones and the dash twos adopted, and then close the work session and come back a week from Monday with a few more amendments that will eliminate our opposition to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is that an hour?
No, Mr. Chair, I think that there are still some issues with the language, and this is the first opportunity I have to see the dash twos, and the dash twos, in my opinion, conflict with the rest of health care in the state in the fact that the employees of other health care organizations would be unable to attend an educational training, and so I'm very interested in how this all proceeds, but I would be supportive of the dash one and dash twos today.
Yeah, the interesting issue on that was not the fellows, because I think residents and fellows were not a problem. The question was, well, how about adding other people, a sonographer, to come and learn about techniques, I mean, about sound, or whatever it is they do, or ultrasound even. And then the question was, I mean, would it be okay? We have pretty strict conflict of interest policies. Would it be okay to add them under a set of conflict of interest policies? I went along with it. If that causes you a problem, then I would suggest we...
No, it caused me, I would agree with that employees have certain relationships and that these, that would be appropriate for them to attend. But on the other side, whether you're in a doctor's office or in a hospital in the state of Oregon, there's reasons that you would want other employees of that organization to attend because they are engaged in some activity that's relevant to the education that's going on.
I think this would still allow your wife to go, but probably not you, because you may not do anything useful.
I was not going to speak of myself.
I think your point's well taken. Let's see. You're waiting to see what else it shakes down. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Anybody wants to shake anything else out of the tree, come and see us. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. I'm gratified to see that there is some working together to make this concept of oversight, I think that's what we'll call it politely, work, but by the same token, I guess, not having been privy to the discussions that you were having to bring this into some consensus form, I'm wondering if we're nearing the point where perhaps the whole purpose of the bill would be moot and the market will be self-regulating itself, as we are hearing that it's doing, or the industry.
Yeah, let me try and say this properly, because we are trying to work closely with the industry. The industry said, here's what we voluntarily do, don't worry.
Correct.
And some people in the community said, well, maybe we still ought to worry, even though they claim that's what they're doing.
There's no, you did say that.
They're not, I mean, there isn't anything that ties them to do it. I mean, well, I wasn't the only one. There were others. So the sense was, well, if that's what you're doing anyway, there shouldn't be any problem putting it into statute. And they are now saying, well, that's okay, if we make a few adjustments to it and you put it in a statute, we can live with that as long as we've got these adjustments that make sure we didn't create any untoward consequences by the rules we use. Turns out they didn't exactly, we couldn't find a document that said, here's the policy that we could, that's what I was hoping, that we could just drop in. It's, you read, well, here's the pieces of the policy. Here's another piece that says, can I do this and not do this? And the answer is, well, yeah, you can do this, but you can't do that. I mean, we had to do a little bit of inferring of what the policy was, and we wanted to make sure we didn't over-infer. So I think we're getting to the point where the skeptics can be satisfied and the industry can be satisfied, and that would be a good place if we can get there.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. one more question, please?
Any number you want, Representative Bonavici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was a companion bill that we heard in the same day that had to do with disclosure instead of prohibition, and I wonder if you could tell us, is this the preferred approach of everybody who was working on this issue, to take the prohibition approach rather than the disclosure?
Well, here's something yet on disclosure. There is some work going on in amending the disclosure bill. Representative Tomei is leading the activity on that. She's been doing some individual investigation and talking. She's very happy to have this and not worry about. One of the objections was having to keep track of a very complex set of disclosures. And she's interested now in amending that to deal with large-scale financial relationships between drug companies and physicians. And she is trying to create some language as we speak on coming up with a form of that bill that could come back before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything else? Can I hear a motion on the dash ones to 2648?
Mr. Chair? I'd move dash one amendments to House Bill 2648.
Is there any discussion on that? Is there any objection? The dash ones are included in 2648. Can I hear a motion on the dash twos?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2648.
Any discussion on that? Any objections to that? Dash 2 to become a part of 2648. Yeah, I do. I'm sorry. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2648. Okay. Right. Okay. Oh, incidentally, let me tell you what I plan to do on 3000 today. Mr. Kotek, you have nearly differently on that. We're going to move that, right? Yeah. I think our intention today is to move House Bill 3000 with a due pass recommendation to the House Agricultural and Natural Resources Committee for substantive discussion there. I think that shouldn't take too long. We are going to get some testimony on House Bill 2801. It's been pointed out to me, but our intention was on 2801 was to invite a few people who were on the list from the subcommittee meeting to testify. It turns out they are all pro-stem cell research advocates, and it was pointed out to me that because the members of the full committee had not heard the pro and con, that we should make sure that we balance that testimony in this so the full committee members can have that opportunity. That makes sense to me. I don't think we have the opponents to the bill ready to testify today, so unless I hear otherwise, so we will hear some of the testimony today that's available, and we'll reschedule. Is that also a week from Monday?
No, next Friday. Sir.
We'll reschedule for Friday next some more invited testimony on 2801, so we can balance the scale somewhat for the full committee to hear.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
If I just might express my appreciation for your consideration and for the committee's information, it was my concern that I had brought to the chair after I exploded at our committee administrator earlier, to whom I offer public apology. But it, just as the chair was respectful to hear my argument, and we did come to agreement that since this committee did not have the benefit of both sides of the discussion, he would consider having the other part of the discussion as well presented to this committee. And I appreciate that very
and
much.
And we may call some brief, since the favorable, we're thinking it was just an add-on to what was going on. We may add a little bit of brief proponent as well to this. So the hearing, so the full committee can see how we'll see how it goes today. But I am leaving some room for that. So it'll all be invited on however we do it. The problem is we have one. I don't want to open up 2801 in full, but we have one proponent who has a real time problem. So what I'm going to do is open it up. We intend to share time among five witnesses, so I'll alert the person that we want to have today to talk about it, that time is going to be limited. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to open up a public hearing. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2801 for invited testimony only, and call Dr. Kenton Gregory. Then there'll be four other witnesses.
Good afternoon, Chairman Greenlich, and members of the Health Care Subcommittee on Health Care Access.
This is the Committee on Health Care.
Health Care Access, I'm sorry. I'm Ken Gregory. I'm a cardiologist from Portland, Oregon. I represent the Oregon Medical Laser Center at Providence St. Vincent Hospital. I'm an assistant professor of biomedical engineering at the Oregon Graduate Institute, assistant professor of medicine and cardiology at OHSU. I'm also the principal investigator of the U.S. Army Battlefield Medical Tissue Regeneration and Replacement Research Program through the U.S. Army Combat Casualty Care Division at Fort Detrick, Maryland. I come before you today to testify in support of House Bill 2801 for the following reasons. Stem cells, although presently controversial, are responsible for virtually all of the healing and limited regeneration that occurs in all of our bodies. They are vital for life and living for every individual, every day of our lives. Stem cells replace our blood cells every day. They replace our cells in our gastrointestinal tract. They replace hair follicle cells. They're present in all of our organs and even our brains. Unfortunately, as we age, we'll work on that for you. We just need to get them going a little bit. Unfortunately, as we age, there are far fewer stem cells, and their function diminishes. And if we have diseases like diabetes, the stem cell functions even less. And that's why one of the reasons we don't heal well from diabetes. It's vital, therefore, that we study, understand, and learn how to use stem cells to help ourselves heal from trauma, disease, and aging. And stem cells are being used commonly worldwide safely. I believe that stem cell therapies will fundamentally change every aspect of medicine and surgery. I think it will be the most profound advance in medicine and surgery in this century. It's important that we bring this ability to heal our patients using stem cells here in Oregon. The collaborative...
Excuse me.
Yes, sir.
I think we might as well keep going with this while it's open, so if the future... The other four witnesses will be ready to follow. That'd be great. Let's go ahead.
The collaborative research group that I founded here in Oregon, which includes all the major universities and the University of OHSU, it's a battlefield trauma research program to save lives through hemorrhage control at the point of injury. And then what we need to do greatly and much better is to rebuild the soldier and give them a full functional life after injury. We've been studying stem cell regeneration for the last 10 years towards this end. There have now been over 20,000 American servicemen and women who've had severe wounds due to blast and other injuries in the Middle East. It has left them disfigured and permanently dysfunctional due to loss of tissue that cannot currently be replaced or regenerated. Based upon our research, we are now actively engaged in funding, designing, and building a human stem cell facility here in Oregon that would be the coordinating center to be used to regenerate arm and leg tissue after blast injury for our American servicemen and women. Soldiers have already volunteered to be treated using this paradigm in the Special Operations Command. We briefed the former Surgeon General, the command staff at Walter Reed, the whole Oregon and Washington congressional delegation, and they're very much behind this program. We helped to start helping soldiers regenerate tissue lost to battlefield injury in 2008. Clinical muscle regeneration lost to heart attacks has been practiced in Germany and is commonplace since 2000. They have a 7-year history. There has not been one side effect from using patients' own stem cells to regenerate heart muscle. In Japan, if you have an extremity wound to trauma, they frequently treat these with stem cells. It's been published for years. So that patients who have had paralysis, who have had muscle weakness or non-healing wounds can walk again. These treatments are treatments we need to provide to our soldiers.
Doctor, as we're talking about the magic and the miracles of stem cells, are we talking about adult stem cells? Are we talking about embryonic stem cells? I mean, you're talking about this generality, and yet the conflict, the controversy of this bill is that it's going to start funding embryonic stem cells, not the other stem cells which are already being funded. Would you clarify that?
Yes. Our program that I'm telling you about for soldiers is using autologous bone marrow as our source for muscle, blood vessel, and nerve regeneration. I think our state needs to recognize the need to study all types of stem cells. There's autologous bone marrow cells. There's stem cells near fat, lots of them. There's amniotic stem cells now that have recently been described, as well as embryonic stem cells. And it's my position that we need to support all of these lines of research. I have a bunch of corny sayings I inflict on my research staff. And nothing works for everything. Nothing works all the time. So
just for clarification, but all of that you've been discussing so far,
those have all been using, I would say that there's been several approaches using stem cells throughout the world. The process that's most commonly used, and at least it shows statistical evidence of benefit in randomized placebo-controlled trials, has been using bone marrow stem cells. I think we're, frankly, a few years away from using embryonic stem cells as a source, but that is not to say we don't know whether these are the ultimate source of stem cells that are going to be best for some diseases. That answer is not known, but we need to find that answer. My guess is that there will be a variety of sources depending on the disease and the person. But we can't tell what are the best stem cells. Right now, because I think it's safe and effective, we're planning on pushing ahead for using some of your own bone marrow through a simple needle aspiration.
Simple needle aspiration. The simple part is depending on which end of the needle you're on.
That's true.
You're scheduled for one.
Yeah. Well, there's a difference between a bone marrow biopsy and a bone marrow if you're having a bone marrow transplant, as we've done for 20 or 30 years to replace bone marrow lost to radiation or chemotherapy. That's where they take about a liter out. That's a serious medical procedure requiring general anesthesia. But for doing limited organ regeneration, it's not much more than a blood draw.
Yeah.
It's just local anesthesia.
Again, depending on which side you're on, right?
Uh-huh.
I remember Bill Walton saying, somebody had asked him about whether a knee operation he was about to have was minor surgery, and his answer was, minor surgery, surgery that happens to somebody else.
Well, I've been on both sides of the table. I prefer to be standing at the bedside myself, so I understand what you're saying. I think that these therapies not only offer great hope and promise, they're being practiced worldwide in other countries safely. I think they also have the potential to reduce hospital costs through accelerated healing, reduced hospital stays, reduced need for hospital surgeries and medical treatments. I think these are all important considerations for something we need to bring to the citizens of the state, and I'm using all my resources to do that. I wish to thank you for the opportunity to testify, especially on such short notice, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Sure.
Senator Maher.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess one thing.
No, you said Senator.
Senator Maher. whichever house you're in.
I got demoted again.
Demoted.
My question is these, you know, the bill clearly is focused on embryonic stem cell. I mean, I'm quite frankly surprised that you know, you're talking about all sorts of stem cell research that probably should be included in this bill, and embryonic should be kind of almost the afterthought if it's included at all. Are the other sources of stem cells, are they played out in the research field? And that's why we're so focused, you know, in this bill on embryonic cell and embryonic stem cell.
Well, but I had the opportunity to read this bill, and I've read it several times. I thought there was room for support of all types of stem cell research. It does have most of the language regarding embryonic stem cell, and that may be appropriate because it is more controversial than autologous bone marrow, for example. And harvesting stem cells from your own fat, probably the least controversial. Although, you have to understand, it's hard to make fat turn into nerve cells. It's a little bit of a stretch to turn bone marrow into nerve cells. The great thing about embryonic stem cells is it's easy to push them into any cell type that you want. I think it was my interpretation of the bill that there is room for support for all types of stem cell research, and I think we should support all of them because we should leave no stone unturned.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you hanging around to be able to testify. we have Dr. Ann Thomas. Next, why don't I? There are four witnesses we're going to hear. Why don't you just come on up? Take this order. Dr. Ann Thomas, Elise Brown, Dr. Michael Wynn, and Eva Ripito.
So, Chair Greenlicht and members of the House Health Care Committee, I'm Dr. Ann Thomas, a medical epidemiologist with the Oregon Public Health Division, and I'm here to testify on House Bill 2801. The bill addresses an important issue, the conduct of human embryonic stem cell research. Stem cell research has the potential to lead to advances in medical care for a number of diseases and possibly has economic benefits for Oregon. This bill would require the department to establish a committee that would develop guidelines for research involving the derivation or use of human embryonic stem cells in Oregon and to create, solicit funds for, and administer a grant fund for this kind of research. The bill would also require DHS to ensure that providers of fertility treatments obtain informed consent from persons who donate embryos for this research and sanction providers who fail to do so. These activities are most appropriate for a biomedical research institution rather than a public health agency. In general, public health does not assess or make recommendations regarding research on medical treatments. In addition, staff would be needed to carry out the activities specified in this bill, and this would require funding that is not included in the governor's recommended budget. Therefore, we cannot support this bill. Thank you.
Yeah, does that say you're opposing the bill?
Yes, sir.
Not just not supporting it.
Correct.
You're opposing the bill because it's not in the governor's budget?
Yes.
I think no is the answer to that.
Okay.
Yes,
not
they are opposing
it.
The bill.
Thanks for that clarification. That's wonderful.
Okay. Is the question you are not opposing the bill? You are just not supporting it. Is that correct?
That's correct. And okay. The reasons are twofold. One, as already mentioned, about the budget, and then the second is we're not sure that's really appropriate for the public health division.
As the place to have a grant program that might support this. Is that the...
Correct.
Great. Thank you. Are there any questions?
It's not a question, but it's a comment about the wording in the second paragraph of her written testimony. The previous witness said, well, it could be interpreted to apply to all aspects of stem cell research, but this, I mean, the way this is worded is... That this bill is focused on human embryonic stem cell research, and so I just think that there's no way that we cannot, and the public is not going to interpret 2801 as anything other than solely focused on human embryonic stem cell research.
I think there's questions.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlich and members of the committee. Elise Brown representing the American Diabetes Association in Oregon. And we are supporters of House Bill 2801 in that we are the recipients of all the research, all kinds of stem cell research, embryonic, adult, and others mentioned. For the committee's reference, more than 245,000 Oregonians have diabetes today, so this is a big opportunity for us to find a cure for both type 1 and controlling type 2. In front of you, I've submitted some written testimony from the Diabetes Association, and even more importantly, on the second page is a stem cell research overview. Last time the bill was up last week, we had the benefit of some great slides that were presented by the scientists in the room, and I think this is just some further explanation so the committee can understand the difference between all the different types of stem cell research. So wanted to share that with you. And then lastly, there was some discussion last time about where we were at the federal level, and I just had the opportunity to notice 10 days or so, the House passed the federal version of this, and just on Wednesday, the Senate passed their stem cell research bill with a 63-34 margin. So that, I only mentioned that because it was brought up last time. So that's it. Thank you very much.
And the other three votes that we're missing are all favorable, still leaving it one short of the ability to override a presidential veto. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair,
yes,
we're just going to have a private offline conversation so I can thump you on the chest.
I thump my own chest.
Comments are just out of order, in my opinion.
I was responding to what the witness said.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having me back. As a reminder, my name is Michael Wynn. I'm a board-certified neurologist practicing here in Salem for about the last 10 years, and I also have a clinical appointment as assistant professor at OHSU. Also, thanks to Representative Maurer for bringing up, again, the specific term embryonic stem cells. So what I'm going to do for the next 5 minutes is take the first half and talk about the science of stem cells a little bit, because it's critical to this entire issue, and then take the last half and talk about how the science relates to the ethical concerns many people have, which I appreciate. After Monday's meeting and in the media, it seems obvious that many people are equating and confusing adult stem cells with embryonic stem cells. They are very different. They are not the same. So please don't do that. Why are they different? Adult stem cells, I think has been touched on already, are found in different organs. So the bone marrow has its own collection of adult stem cells. Those cells are limited to forming cells of the blood. Red blood cells, white blood cells, whatever. That's really pretty much it. They cannot form brain or muscle. Adult stem cells are limited in number. They're hard to find, and they're actually fairly hard to grow in the laboratory. So there are some significant limitations with adult stem cells. Embryonic stem cells, you've already heard here again, are easy to find, easy to obtain, and have really no limitations as to what they can develop into. And it's a critical difference between the two populations. So please don't let someone say, well, adult stem cells will give us all the information we need. That's all we need to do. That is just incorrect. It's important to understand where we get embryonic stem cells. In fertility clinics across this country, every day, eggs are selected from a woman who wants to be a mother. They're put in a petri dish and fertilized. 3 to 5 days later, they're looked at by a technician, because by that time, they're called blastocysts. A blastocyst is a little cyst, a little fluid-filled clump of cells that has about 50 to 150 cells at one end, and those are the stem cells. All those cells are the same. They have not formed organs. They have not differentiated in any way. So stem cells are all the same. And the technician looks at the blastocyst and then selects a few of them for reimplantation. Other blastocysts are left in that dish and are disposed of. So every day, essentially every week in this country, blastocysts are either frozen or disposed of. that's, I think, a critical point, because this gets to the last half of what I'm going to say, is that many people have the concern that what they say is they support life. Well, I support life, too. And what they're doing when they say that, in fact, someone said that today in the news, that it's not right to take from one human and give to another human in terms of life issues. They're equating on the same level a blastocyst with a human being. I think that's ethically and morally severely challenged. And frankly, I think that demonstrates a lack of faith. And what I mean by that is we are a lot different than a blastocyst. It's denying what makes us human. What makes us human is our creativity, our ability to care for each other, ability to be cared for by someone else. That's what makes us human. We are not blastocysts. To put it another way, before I came over for this meeting, I stopped by the hospital to make rounds. I went into the hospital and I diagnosed and I treated as best I could, and I cared for human beings. I didn't diagnose, I didn't treat, I didn't care for blastocysts. Blastocysts are not humans. It's a very profound difference, and I think that when people make that case, that's very problematic to say that. So that's actually all I have to say, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. I have a question. Senator?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have a disease-oriented question. So you say, I've just, and this is helping educate me a little bit on the mm-hmm. on the stem cells in general, because I wasn't part of the other committee. Adult stem cells, what we know today, the only benefit from adult stem cells are blood-related.
Oh, no, I think there are other... That's the most prominent therapeutic benefit that's been demonstrated in clinical trials. I think there are other, you know, probably imminent therapeutic benefits, but blood issues are the most prominent.
Let me pick a specific disease, and I realize it's sure. what's one person's opinion, but type 1 diabetes. Mm-hmm. Adult stem cells have no... At this point, have no... what are the values of adults, what the scientific world knows right now, mm-hmm. the values toward type 1 research from the adult stem cell versus the embryonic stem cells? Where is it? Is there anything on the adult side? I know there's stuff on the embryonic side.
Sure. I'm not a diabetologist, but I'm sure there's benefit from adult stem cells, because the idea would be you would isolate adult stem cells from the pancreas, make insulin, you can infuse them, and that person can make insulin. So I think that, to be clear, we must study adult stem cells. But because embryonic stem cells can develop into anything, and because they're easier to grow, and you can develop large populations of them, that's what's going to be needed in a lot of those diseases. So we're really tying one hand behind our back if we say, oh, we'll just do for type 1 diabetes or whatever, adult stem cells. They have the limitations I talked about that will severely limit them, I think.
Okay. I just want to make sure, because in your testimony you said that adult mm-hmm. stem cells are specifically related, and maybe I overheard that, but specifically related to blood issues. You're yeah. saying, no, it's broader than that. We don't know everything,
right.
but it's broader.
Well, that's the stem cells that are taken from bone marrow.
Right. You could take a stem cell from liver. Almost every organ has its own reserve of stem cells. Mm-hmm. They're there for backup to make new liver cells, blood okay. cells, skin okay. cells, name the organ. So, no, it's not just blood.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Flores.
And thank you. And for Representative Bruin's information and reference, and perhaps for the committees as well, I'm glad you brought up type 1 diabetes, because I have in front of me that just from the research that I did, 73 benefits to human patients, adult stem cells versus embryonic stem cells. Type 1 diabetes is listed under autoimmune diseases under the adult stem cell research. And by the way, these are all from peer-reviewed studies and not from embryonic stem cells. And there are quite a few categories here, and I'd be happy to make copies available to you, except I have not gone through the peer-reviewed research. This is a synthesis of those.
Mr. Chair, can I
please
one more question? And this goes back to the point that with the prior panel that Representative Maurer brought up. Doctor, I appreciate a great testimony. Do you have any problem with taking House Bill 2801 and not necessarily changing, certainly not eliminating the language and the plainness, if you will, toward embryonic stem cell, but broadening it to include other?
No,
I make it a broader rather than a fairly narrow bill.
Not at all. I mean, whatever soapbox I have, I said all stem cells need to be studied. The genetics of embryonic stem cells are profoundly different than the genetic mechanisms of adult. So Monday we talked about treatment, diagnostic possibilities and testing possibilities, and you're not going to get all those if you limit yourself to adult stem cells, because their gene mechanism is different than embryonic stem cells.
Thank you.
Are you going to work on a...
You're going to put a...
We have time.
Okay.
I don't think the sponsor would have a problem with that. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Nguyen, in regard to your comments generated by Representative Bruin and kind of trying to decentralize the focus here from human embryonic stem cells, which is pretty much the focus in Section 3, and you said, I believe I heard you say you'd read this bill a number of times, and this clearly is the focus, as well as somatic cell nuclear transfer, which is interpreted as cloning.
Right.
And so understanding that in your estimation, human embryonic stem cells or their blastocysts are not caring, loving, and whatever adjective I think you provided.
Creative.
What about the element of focusing or limiting this whole discussion and debate on the research pertaining to adult stem cells, as opposed to not only lifting out embryonic stem cell, but the human cloning element?
Well, I think the way to think of it, if I understand the question correctly, is so many of these diseases, including Alzheimer's, diabetes, there's a genetic component, not in terms of hereditary, but the reason people develop these diseases is certain genes don't work right. So we have certain genes don't work right.
Right, but you're saying Alzheimer's, and are you aligning that with embryonic stem cell research?
Absolutely.
And can you give us examples of some of that research on Alzheimer's specifically?
That's what I'm going to do. In order to understand why genes in Alzheimer's either produce too much protein, which is what happens, or they don't process it correctly, we have to understand how those genes work. Stem cell research as a whole, across the spectrum of stem cell research, needs to be available to understand that process. So it's not so much cloning versus adult versus embryonic. It's really how do we understand how genes work? That's really what we're trying to do. That's what we need to do in science to help Oregonians. How do genes work? So therefore, that's why I would like to not say, well, let's do cloning, but let's not do adult or vice or picture. Mix and match. It's really genes. How do genes work? Embryonic stem cells have a unique genetic apparatus because they can develop into anything. Okay? Adult stem cells can't do that. Cloning is not really a case of developing into anything. It's a separate issue looking at gene transfer. So that's how I think the argument should be phrased. If we limit ourselves, then we're not going to find out. Simple as that. Now we can do it in Oregon. California's going to do stem cell research, and we can do that. So people, you know, will have more of a brain drain from this state. They'll go someplace else, and they'll do the research. And then people who are opposed to this research, for valid reasons, I am not discounting anybody's feelings about this. Then down the line, when there are advances in stem cell research, all kinds, that lead to treatment for these diseases, the people who have opposed it are going to have a problem. When they come down to something, and I'm as risk as everyone else, what are they going to do with those treatments? Certainly they want to take advantage of them. That's why I think we should do this in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, one more follow-up.
Please.
No, go ahead.
You hit on a point that I hadn't thought about in a while. I followed the California, which I think was a ballot measure.
It was
upfront promoted by the governor, but it was a ballot measure. Can you talk a little bit, in your opinion, you covered it in broad terms, but does this set, in your opinion, failure to implement something like 2801, even if it's a broader or a close but broader bill, do you think it puts OHSU at a competitive disadvantage in the stem
sure.
cell? Okay.
Money's already left the state, going out of state to California.
Even with Mr. Chair, if I may, even with the stem cell program that the good stem cell program that OHSU already has in place, without this legislation, you see it putting us at
clearly,
a broader competitive
clearly.
Disadvantage. Okay.
With California, the ballot measure, $3 billion. That's real money for stem cell research.
So, okay. Representative Flores, I'll say it passed by a large margin. Is that?
Yes, it did.
Okay.
And that's supposed
Am
to
I
what?
Get
what for me?
No, I wonder whether I'm going to get
a whole lot.
Chest thump.
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Just checking. It's about a
Kevlar. I'll pass. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, just as an addition to that, So somewhere Oregon is limiting stem cell research?
Well, right, my understanding.
We don't have a commission. I mean, we can solve every issue with a commission, so creating a commission is going to bring $3 billion into the state of Oregon?
I think passage of this bill and creating a commission is going to put Oregon on the map as supporting stem cell research and willing to look into all avenues to help Oregonians with these diseases. And that's a very powerful statement. Then investors and corporations will say, Oregon's a place to do business. Oregon's a place where we're going to send our scientists to work and produce. So I think, I mean, I know there's not money in this bill, but it's a powerful statement.
There's a possibility of money. There's a fund that's produced, which is getting a raise means.
We're going to take that money from what?
Prisons?
B-12 education.
Well, there's also private money.
That's my point. I mean, we're not limited today, and OHSU is conducting this today.
I don't think OHSU is doing much with embryonic stem cell research at all.
So then it gets back to 2801 is about embryonic stem cells.
Is there any question about it? It is about human embryonic stem cell research. President Brown suggests he might want to increase that to talk about adult stem cells as well. I think that's a great idea, because I think all the testimony we've had is we ought to have a full range of research. But it says it's about human embryonic stem cell research. There's no question about that.
Mr. Chair, it focuses on embryonic stem cell research.
Yeah.
Right. So that's clearly the focus of this bill, and cloning.
That's what I said. Yeah, it is clearly the focus of this bill.
Okay.
It is the intended focus of this bill. It is clearly the focus of this bill.
I will ask my question, Mr. Chair, if you'll allow me.
Absolutely. You keep a rain check for any, you have any number of rain checks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm not on the Access Committee, so I didn't hear your testimony before, and I have nowhere near a science background. So I just want to confirm my understanding of your testimony about the stem cell comes from the blastocyst, right? And if this... If the blastocyst isn't used for anything, it's discarded. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That's all I wanted to confirm. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Very understandable. A good thing in this field. Not universal.
Yes.
Chair Green Mike and members of the committee, thank you for allowing testimony on HB 2801 to be heard today and for allowing me to speak. My name is Eva Ripito. You may see me running around the building as I'm part-time legislative assistant to Representative Galizio. I come here today to put on the record a concern expressed by some of the organizations that support stem cell research and on the bill specifically that they asked me to bring up, and to implore you to read all of the information provided you. Some of the experts and organization members could not be here today that did not get heard on Monday. They have all turned in written statements, and I'd like to encourage you to read the statements and contact me or those folks if you have any questions. Everyone has given me their contact information and highly recommends asking questions. And if you don't have their contact, you can come to me for that. In the testimony from stem cell research supporters, you'll find a concern over the Oversight Committee appointment. Organizations such as Juvenile Diabetes Foundation, ALS Association, and Parkinson's Resources were concerned that appointments by the governor would politicize the committee and would prefer an appointment come from university presidents and deans. For those of you struggling with this topic, I would like to strongly encourage you to read the chapter from the Honorable Senator Orrin Hatch's book, Square Peg. His office gave me permission to share copies with you, and if you do not get a copy for your bill file, please feel free to ask me for another. In that chapter, he writes about how embryonic stem cell research falls perfectly in line with his pro-life beliefs. Embryonic stem cell research is not about destroying lives. It's about improving quality of life for those stricken with debilitating diseases and hopefully finding a cure for them, or more succinctly put, saving lives. These cells are nothing more than cells if they do not have a uterus in which to grow. Senator Hatch describes it best when he compares them to seeds. Without soil, they cannot become plants. So the question becomes, do we let the cells left over from in vitro fertilization to expire and be thrown away, or do we allow for research that may save lives? Thank you again for the opportunity to speak to you, and I will try to answer any questions that you have. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you even for being here. And the testimony prior was just to the Access Committee, so the rest of us would appreciate receiving that, I'm sure.
I will make lots of copies for you.
Did the rest of us get that chapter?
Yeah.
Only the Access.
Only the Access.
I didn't notice it. Mm-hmm. We will arrange together.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And, Mr. Chair, the packet, just for the record, the testimony is behind, in the packet, meeting packet, behind your SMS, that Eva was referring to, and there are remarks from Linda Lester, MD. I'm sorry, is it Lauren Burke, MD, and...
I was trying to find out, did we get...
And Ann Wallace, just for the record, so it's submitted into the record.
Mr. Chair, the excerpt from Senator Hatch's book is in the packet that the Access Committee received from Representative Galizio.
That's in Chapter 11, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, I do have it. Thank you. You make sure everybody else gets that.
I will.
The whole packet.
I was going to say, we'll just get the whole packet to everybody.
Okay. Before I close, let me make an unusual suggestion.
I can tell.
We can discuss this during a work session, but if I would suggest if any of the members of the committee are interested in testifying, I'm thinking of testifying on the bill. I'm a co-sponsor, but I think if anybody would like to testify, let Sandy know. I think it would be useful. It could give you a chance to get your ideas in some coherent form and present them to the committee. It would be a useful thing. So let Sandy know if you would like to.
Mr. Chair, I was getting water. Maybe didn't hear the front end of your comment. What is your plan with this? I mean, timeline. I know you want to move it,
the
but
plan,
or work.
Are we putting it back on next Friday?
Correct.
Next Friday. Okay.
With more invited testimony. Opponents and possibly proponents.
Okay. We'll see.
Chair Green.
Yes.
Are you,
Chair Cote?
Thank you, Chair. Are you entertaining any amendments? And the reason I ask is I see some suggestions from Ann Wallace's email testimony. I think the concerns brought up by DHS about proper placement for the committee. Did you hear any discussion around that in the subcommittee?
We did not hear. We did hear DHS, I did hear informally, DHS thought their department wasn't the proper place to manage a grant, a commission, and a grant, is that right? And they had a particular suggestion. I always listen to everything DHS says, but I don't think their suggestion is the right one. In this case, although maybe it is, but it is something we should think about. I suggested Representative Bruin get an amendment. I would say this would be a good time to get them, in time for... I don't think we can delay action on whatever that action is beyond next Friday.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay, I'll close the hearing on 2801 and open the work session on 2801. Oh, I was going to open a work session on 3342, but Richardson's doing that, and he just stepped out. Let's open, I assume he'll be back. He needs his glasses.
He'll be
back. He left his peanuts, so he'll be back.
Let's open a work session on House Bill 3331, which comes to us from the Policy Committee, I think, with unanimous vote. Or about that. And Representative Gelzer is carrying it for us.
Mr. Fair, would you like me to just brief the committee?
I would love you to brief us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as you said, this comes from the Policy Subcommittee with a unanimous vote. Due pass to the full committee, it establishes a personal income tax credit for individuals who have donated certain transplanted organs during a tax year. It limits the credit to lesser of 50% of the personal income tax liability or $1,000. It applies to transplant operations that has occurred during a tax year beginning on or after January 1, 2008 and before January 1, 2013. This does have a subsequent referral to revenue. And Representative Gelzer will provide additional information.
Thank you, Sandy. This bill I introduced at the request of Chris Chapman, who is herself a living donor. She donated a kidney. And the bill was brought because when a person donates a kidney or donates a partial liver, it's a pretty serious undertaking, very serious medical consequences, which results in a fair amount of time off work. So the individual takes a financial hit. So it's a very small tax credit with a maximum amount of $1,000 to help that individual be able to meet those expenses. They won't gain anything from this. It's not going to be a money-making thing to give your kidney away. It would have a very, to donate your kidney to someone who needs it. I'm sorry, I did not use a very good phrase there. In 2006, there were only 103 total donors in the state of Oregon. That include those who were living donors that this would apply to and those who were no longer living. So it would have a very minimal revenue impact and would result in providing some help to individuals who have shown really the greatest compassion and generosity, selfless generosity to others. So I hope that we can consider doing this. It would also be very small. Several other states have done this, 10 other states, and they actually provide a $10,000 credit.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to ask a question, please, of Representative Gelzer, if that's all right.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Representative Gelzer, I'm glad you mentioned the other states, because $1,000 doesn't seem like much for somebody who's given so much and is probably missing a significant amount of work. So is there a reason why, and because there's obviously a very small number of people that this is affecting, is there a reason why the $1,000 amount was selected?
I would, Representative Bonamici, I would have to ask Chris, who drafted the portions of the bill. However, when I went and talked with the organ donation advocacy organization, they did have a concern about the bill, that they wanted it to be a nominal credit, because part of the point of organ donation is that it's a very philanthropic act. And they were very concerned about supporting anything that would appear to be
buying kidneys.
Something like that, yes.
And I think I recall Ms. Chapman saying something to the effect of it was a place to start.
Yes, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Flores.
Thank you. And also to Representative Gelzer, did you in the committee discuss the range of possible donations? I mean, this is focused on kidney and liver. I don't know much about this field, but I would want to assure that we're not unintentionally excluding other types of donors that may also undergo, you know, significant work loss and should, in fact, benefit from this type of credit.
Thank you, Representative Cannon. Again, I think that the idea was that this was a place to start. We have very few organs that we're able to donate while we continue to live without them. That pretty much limits it to kidneys, partial liver, and bone marrow. And bone marrow is a pretty big net to cast to start. But this would be a starting place for the most invasive types of gifts.
Anything else?
I just one follow-up was just I'm interested in the subject, so thank you for indulging me. I guess the extent of need, is there an unmet need in terms of liver and kidney donation, and if so, how great is that?
There's a huge unmet need for kidneys. A long list. Many people die before they end up getting a kidney donation. Also through liver, a huge unmet need for both these areas.
No. Yes. Thanks.
And, Mr. Chair, if I might, in the Health Subcommittee, I don't have the bill files from the rest of that day, and in our Human Services Committee, we've been receiving testimony about the numbers of individuals both in Oregon and elsewhere who die each year waiting on transplant lists in order to receive organs. And what's very interesting, if I might add, in the second bill that we received that talks about people who were donating, in 1 year, over half of those who donated were those who were, in fact, living donors for total transplants in the state of Oregon, which is a very good reason to sign up on the registry if you have determined to be a donor.
This is broken.
Representative Bruin.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Kane, I appreciate the question. Of course, it leaves out a lot of us conservative Republicans who are living heart donors, but, you know, next time we'll get to that. next time.
I think there would be a few requests off the floor.
I won't sign on to that bill.
Does that lead to a chest dumping later on?
It opens the opportunity, doesn't it?
Getting giddy.
It's Friday afternoon. Do I hear a motion on 3331?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I would move. Oh, I would move House Bill 3331 to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation.
3331 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with subsequent referral to Revenue. We got instructed on
we went
by
this
Ramona.
Last week.
So it goes to the floor first and then it goes through?
Well, it does, yes.
Here we go.
Yes.
History repeats itself.
It goes to the floor in the form of the Speaker's desk and then is goes to Revenue.
And instead of
so
saying.
We are actually referring it to the
it's
floor.
It's a housekeeping issue.
It is.
It's all parliamentarian.
Thank you for explaining this because I had this question in another committee earlier today and now my whole day makes sense.
You too can tell. Right. It goes to the clerk's office.
Stay to the floor.
Yeah.
But it goes
but
to the
symbolically
floor.
To correct. The, symbolically exactly. To the Speaker's desk.
Exactly. Good memory.
So we have a motion to move House Bill 3331 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Revenue. Is there any discussion on that? Yes. Let's see whether he wants to come in and vote. We can open it back up for you. We'll open it back up.
Until it goes.
45 minutes. Okay, and 45 minutes. All right. Move your bill. I can drink it. Aaron, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Delson.
Aye. Representative
Maurer.
Aye. Vice Chair
Potek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Green.
Aye. Motion passes. We'll close the work session on HB 3331 and open a work session on HB 3342.
Carrier.
Sandy?
Carrier?
Goes to Revenue.
Oh. I know.
Sandy, will you talk to us about 3342?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. This 3342 comes to you from a committee member, Representative Richardson. It comes from the Access Subcommittee. We had a public hearing on and work session on April 4th. It requires the Department of Human Services to establish by rule a program to make grants of not more than $100,000 per county per calendar year for the purpose of administering public guardian or conservator program. It requires the counties that wish to qualify to provide at least 25% of an amount received by DHS. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Richardson needs to leave with very high-level politics. He's on his way. I'll be happy to carry it, but would somebody else from the Access Committee like to explain what this is?
I'm sorry, I missed your question.
You can't. You're not in the Access.
No, I was going to ask if we were going to get an explanation for the reason.
Yes, you are going to get an explanation. I was willing to do it, but I was asking whether anybody else in Access wanted to do it.
Representative Maurer.
Representative Maurer, do you want to? Actually,
yes, Mr. Chair.
It comes from your part of the country.
Yeah, good bill should pass.
That means you have time to read it? Is that what I'm talking about?
No, this, the bottom, this bill, what it does is it creates us a reimbursement for people that do not have any other type of guardianship available to them when they are unable to take care of themselves. And most of the time, family takes care of it. But there are times when the courts make that decision. And so what this does is it provides some reimbursement to those people that take on this role under the guise of the court, if I'm not mistaken. It is, am I incorrect on saying the court?
Yeah, well, we heard some extraordinary testimony from Multnomah and
Jackson County. Jackson County.
The only two counties that have it. And what the issue is, there are people in the community who start getting frail. And they don't have any relatives, and they run across by caseworkers or other, and pretty soon they have early Alzheimer's, they have other kinds of problems, they're beginning to get frail, and there isn't any way to get them either guardianship or
conservatorship
or financial protection. There are three different levels of it. What these programs do is they're on the lookout from this through other social service agencies, and when they come across somebody who is alone and without family resources, they step in and move to the courts and create the proper level of service. We hear just pretty extraordinary testimony. The problem is, of course, this is, what do we have, 34 counties or something? I think this is only a proposal to fund up to 20 counties, which is still $2 million, and we're not really sure it's going to be able to get out of Ways and Means, but the committee was really, I was very cool on this bill before listening to testimony, and what I still say, would I trade this $2 million for some other $2 million? After hearing the testimony, I'd say I might. This might be something that would really be useful. And, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm a little bit confused about what happens now, absent this bill, in those circumstances when there is someone frail like that. And I've always heard of court-appointed guardians, and I'm just assuming that the court finds a guardian somehow. Is that not accurate?
Yeah, if somebody brings it to the court, what these people do is make sure they're alert for these on outreach, paying attention, and then bring them to the court. If somebody brings it to the court now in one of these other counties, they can't afford a guardian, but the problem is getting these people where they need to get.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to quote some testimony that was from Dawn Brulin, who is the Senior Disability Services Coordinator for Rogue Valley Council of Governments, which is Jackson and Josephine County. In the majority of cases, you have a family member or a friend who accepts this responsibility. But there are, however, a limited number of situations where there is no family member or friend who is willing, able, or appropriate to perform these services for individuals at risk. Unfortunately, in some of these situations, it is from family members or so-called friends that the individual must be protected in abuse cases, exploitation cases. In these cases, a public guardian program is not only appropriate but essential if the person is protected and the public resources are not to be wasted. And it goes on, but basically it's to help those people that are truly being taken advantage of, physically abused, and have no place else to go. And so the court does, in fact, appoint somebody.
Representative Flores.
Go ahead, Representative Bonamici.
I was going to ask the chair to call on you.
Oh, thank you.
I was thinking about the testimony. I was lost in thought, and I'm sorry.
Thank you, Representative Maurer, for referencing that prior testimony. I'd just like to unpack this a little bit. Guardianships are someone who is assigned to guard over a person. conservatorships is a mechanism to protect the person's assets. I think in the staff summary it also talks about their person, but it's their assets. And there currently are mechanisms by the court that are, as Representative Bonamici said, court-appointed guardians. Now, am I to understand you're telling us that that's only happening in Multnomah and Jackson County?
No, the organized services that is happening in the metropolitan area, actually, also in Washington County, that's in testimony. It's the organized services of finding these people, seeing where they are, and bringing them to court. In Washington County, they said that they're able to take care of about 10% of the ones that are referred to them, and the others they're not able to take care of at all. And they don't know what happens to them. But they get referrals, and they have just enough money. It's all from private funds in Washington County. And I think they said they handle about 10%. They handle about 20. They're able to handle about 20 cases a year because of some organization that's just doing it out of their money, the Senior Guardianship Assistance Program. And they receive, I think they said, about 100 a year. And they don't know what happens to the other 80 because they don't have the funds to do anything about them.
That's my legal term for the day.
That is what? Your legal term?
My legal term.
What they said, the last sentence of the Washington County, he says, when Senior Gap started in 2004, Washington County Department of Aging and Veterans Services had available approximately $90,000 to use for paying for guardianship, conservatorship, or money management service. SGAP was one of two agencies who received the funds via an annual contract with the county department to provide their services for those who could not afford to pay. We no longer receive this support from the county, and the county no longer financially supports guardian and conservator services. It's difficult to say no to those who need help, knowing there isn't a person or organization in Washington County that can be used as a guardian of last resort. Sometimes a private professional fiduciary is willing to take a case pro bono. Sometimes Adult and Protective Services can place a person in the care setting that helps them stay safe. Other times, the person continues to fail until another system takes over. In other words, the police are called, the client is hospitalized, or Adult Protective Services is called repeatedly.
And I would echo that. Though the hospitals have procedures to address these situations, they take time, and meanwhile, the individual is using up resources for which the hospital is unlikely to be reimbursed. Since the individuals that we're talking about are frequent flyers to hospitals, this can become a very costly proposition. And so I think they just float. You know, they're just there. And that the system deals with them one way or the other.
Oh, thank you. One comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One comment and two questions. It looks like I received the report to the governor and the legislature on the Long-Term Care Advisory Committee, and they particularly speak to the fact that Oregon's one of the only states who doesn't have a statewide public guardian program, and it's one of their recommendations to try to, I think, get this started in the state. Around the money issue, I just want to clarify if I'm reading this bill correctly. It's not requiring, first of all, the 20 counties that you referenced, I don't see that in the bill. So is that something brought up in testimony? There is a 25% match required.
Yes.
Which I think is great that there's a match in there. It also says up to $100,000. So it's not required that the state spend $100,000 per county. So it could be less than that. And I think this would be a good way of leveraging or providing a jump start to get that 25% match and to get things going in certain counties. So I think the fiscal might be less than we are anticipating, or could be less, because it does not, you know, say they have to put $100,000 in 36 counties. It's up to, and it might depend on who has the match. So we could be looking at a smaller amount for the jump start around the state, so, which I think is, it's nicely written in that way, I think. Start off small and see where it goes.
We actually also heard, you may remember, some testimony in the televised hearing that we had from Jackson County.
Right, Don. It was the same gentleman.
It was the same person who testified with essentially the same testimony. It was much more powerful in person. It was interesting than over the air. Yes, I'm sorry.
Oh, I can wait if somebody else had their hand up.
Go.
I was wondering if you would like a motion on this.
I would like a motion.
I would move House Bill 3342 to the floor with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Well, the do pass recommendation.
Do pass recommendation.
Great. Representative Flores, were you in line for comment? We have a motion on the floor now. Good time for comments.
Well, you do have motion on the floor, so this would be a comment time, and I guess my only question is, this is directing the Department of Human Services to establish a program, funnel some funding to the county dependent upon a 25% match from the county. So if it's a program that's required to be in place, but the county doesn't come up with a 25% match, what happens?
No, it isn't required to be in place in the county. It's only required to be available as a state assistance program.
They apply for grants.
Sounds like
the county has to apply for grants to help with that.
Right. You would have the money in place.
You'd have the 25%.
Yeah, if the county desired.
Got it.
I assume this would come under aging and what's it called now?
Senior disabled.
It's pretty broad.
People with disabilities.
That's right. Seniors and people with
disabilities. Seniors and
SPD.
People with age and with disability.
People with age.
Well, what was the bill about people with disabilities?
Representative Ford.
I think people with age is a good thing, too.
But we do have testimony from the department. The department does support the concept of creating additional guardianship conservative resources, but obviously it's not in the governor's budget. And basically they don't say whether they support, oppose, but they are supportive of the concept.
Not allowed to support any bill that's not in the budget.
And thank you, Representative Maurer, for saying that, because, see, this is all I would have in my file. I came today and got the staff major summary. I don't have the benefit of all the information that you had. So.
Likewise.
Would it make sense to distribute the testimony to the
Absolutely. Yes.
You wouldn't feel overwhelmed by it.
No.
To be fair, at least it's a selection of things that
if the full committee wants all the materials from the Access Committee, they can get it. But unfortunately, Representative Kotek, Madam Vice Chair, it would be very hard for us to try and ascertain what you're going to view as important. So, unfortunately, if the subcommittee gets this much, then a non-subcommittee member will get this much, too. So don't be rolling your eyes when you see healthcare materials that are volumes. And that's totally up to your, if you guys are okay getting that.
Information is power.
Okay?
Yeah, I was thinking
not a problem.
Maybe the chairs of the two subcommittees could go over with you on anything that we had moved here and help you make some decisions about what to do.
You mean me or
other members? Tina and me help you on things that came out of our committee.
Mr. Chair?
Tina, does that make sense to you?
I'm open to that, but
I appreciate that you're willing to spend that time, but I know we all probably look at things differently, and I'm happy to. I like to read late at night these materials. So.
We'll try and end up not being too much of a burden on committee services. We'll do it if it turns out impossible.
After every subcommittee, then the full committee will get packets from the subcommittee meeting on all the bills.
Only on the bills that are moving for action.
If
they're not going to come to us for a vote, then it makes no sense to have the information.
Okay.
Yeah, only in the ones that are moving for action.
Okay. There might be a little hiccup in there.
We'll try it.
Yeah. I mean, because obviously it's much easier for us to just turn around and make packets of everything that we heard and said, and then distribute them to your office rather than figure out, okay, we're not going to have this, we are going to have this. So it would really streamline us to just give you everything from subcommittees.
Let's talk about the vice chair's meeting.
Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'm changing the subject back to the bill because I have a question.
Wasting time on the bill we're voting on?
The bill.
The money involved in this, it says may make grants. Where's the money going to go? Is it to establish the program, or is it to pay the guardians? Is it to recruit people to be guardians, to train them?
I think the program includes all of those things.
Mr. Chair,
I think some of the testimony that we heard spoke to the importance of allowing some flexibility at the local level, and which is why the bill doesn't specify. I think the programs, existing programs, are different county to county, and I think the bill just wants to encourage more of that independence, autonomy, and creativity at the local level.
And if I may, I'm assuming that a lot of that criteria would be worked out in the rulemaking process in terms of the grant program and how it would be set up. They would set some criteria. If you're going to apply for money, you would have to do, I'm sure, I assume something before they, and that would be a public process for the rulemaking. Thank you.
The motion on the table is ready to vote on.
Looks like we're silent. So.
Aaron, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Representative Bruin. Aye. Representative Cannon. Aye. Representative Flores. Aye. Representative Delfer. Aye. Representative Maurer. Aye. Vice Chair Kotek. Aye. Vice Chair Richardson. Excuse? Aye. Motion passes. And I'll close the work session on, is it 3342? I crossed out the number. Okay, we're done with it. Okay. H32946 is, that's the Kohler?
Yes.
Okay.
That is the Maurer Kohler.
We heard, this is a bill by Representative Maurer, encouraging President Emeritus Kohler of OHSU to meddle in the healthcare system in a positive way. Would you explain the bill to us?
I'm sure he'll love hearing that.
Positive meddling is great.
Yeah.
Before you have a Hamm and Gross version of House Bill 2946. It includes the Dash 1 Amendment. So I'm going to use the Hamm and Gross version. Essentially, what the department requested is an amendment to allow them to seek a waiver from the Center for Medicaid, for Medicare and Medicaid Services, to test this alternative health care delivery system program. And that this is a pilot program and not a program that changes radically anything, but this is a healthcare delivery reform bill, and there is no fiscal associated with it. And so we all did a two thumbs up, and that was a good thing. It also changes the evaluation criteria that states that it would improve health assessment, data collection, and decision making. And also puts a sunset on this bill of January 2, 2012. And if there are questions about what Dr. Kohler is doing, I would be more than happy to answer those questions.
Yes, Representative Cannon.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Maurer. And I don't have a question about what Dr. Kohler is doing because I saw his presentation. However, I do have a question about the amendment and the approval for the waiver from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So would this mean, I mean, would this waiver be applying for different use of Medicaid or Medicare dollars that the state is receiving? And I guess what's the trade-off there? What are we not doing if we receive the waiver in order to do this pilot project instead?
Well, I think it's not, the waiver is not taking anybody out of Medicaid. It's not adding anybody into Medicaid. What it's dealing with is a population within a clinic that exists today is using an alternative delivery model, which is, it's a way of using lower level technicians, certified nursing assistants, to collect evaluation and assessment data that will assist higher level providers in making a quicker and more accurate differential diagnosis of the patient that they're seeing, thus making the system more efficient, being able to see more people in a shorter amount of time and putting the most sick people with the appropriate level of provider.
And just
the waiver is to allow
CNAs to do things that under current Medicaid rules have to be done by an RN or a physician.
And be reimbursed for those services.
And get reimbursed under, with the computer assist.
Yes.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Now, can you address the sunset date a little bit? Because it's a pilot project, 6 years or 5 years, whatever it is from today, would be a time to conduct a program and have some...
I think you will. Yeah, absolutely.
Application.
Yeah. 2012 is a very appropriate length of time. It's not too soon, and it's not too far off that this law will disappear if things don't work out. But obviously, if they do work, then we have several sessions to come back and make changes to this piece of legislation. In fact, I would suggest that if things did work out for this concept, maybe not just this specific program, but this concept, that this will lead to other changes in how we deliver health care that will actually improve, be more efficient, and improve the use of the dollars that we do have, even though they are limited dollars.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, I just reiterate, you know, that sounds like a pretty exciting endeavor, and I see a nice little presentation over here that would help inform my thinking on this, and all I have is the bill, the staff major summary, the edits, and the... amendment and the hand engrossed, and so it's kind of not very sexy.
Okay, well, we will try it. Yeah, there is a very informative system, and near as I can make out, Dr. Cole is willing to do a demonstration anywhere, anytime, for anybody.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask a question to Representative Maurer.
I'm sorry.
Can I please ask a question to Representative Maurer?
Will the carrier accept it? Oh, no, yes.
Thank you. Representative Maurer, I see that this need to ask approval, it was added. Is that a pro forma type process, or is there a chance it could be denied?
Chance it could be denied, absolutely. But the program exists today, and in a, I don't know if you'd call it a beta form, but it exists today. And what this is, he needs a population from which to test this in a larger, everyday kind of way, you know, rather than just a small, you know, experiment in the, you know, a clinical trial. We need to broaden this to a phase two trial where we're actually using some people, and it does not, you know, it does not present anybody with a threat or a... They're still going to provide the services they would normally provide, but today they're going to do it in a little different way. And so, yes, there is, it clearly CMS could come back and say no, but this type of waiver, DHS has, I want to say assured, but DHS understands that this kind of waiver is very common, and that it is a formality, but it's not. So, you know, I would say it's a 90-10 split that we're going to get the waiver.
Yeah, I mean, I was really surprised at how little they were asking for when they came with the bill. Yes, Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Maurer, I just have a question for you, if I could. On line 10, it talks about, makes reference to lower-cost frontline providers. Could you elaborate on that a little bit and what we're talking about there? And I heard the mention of maybe CNAs doing different things and getting reimbursed for it. Is that what we're talking about there, you know, using staff differently based
yes.
on their expertise?
Well, there's a concept of using providers at the highest level of their license. And it's not about taking a CNA and using them beyond what their normal scope of practice is, but it is using them at the top of their scope of practice rather than the bottom. And again, registered nurses, using them at the top of their license as opposed to doing the things that are at the bottom, i.e. taking blood pressure, which, you know, everybody needs to know how to do that. Well, all healthcare providers at any level need to know how to do that. And I don't, by the way. But the point is, it's about raising, it's about giving the provider, whether it's a nurse practitioner or physician, better evaluate assessment information when you do an intake of a patient so that the doctor has the best information. How many times do we go in and you sit down with the nursing assistant in, you know, in many clinics, get your blood pressure, they'll ask you a couple of questions, you go to the next office, and you get asked the same questions again. Uh-huh. And so this is about eliminating that, and so that actually the CNA is now more effective, can ask better questions because this program is, it's an algorithm, and that the questions get better, more specific, so that the physician or nurse practitioner has, you know, they have a different starting place.
A follow up?
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's really interesting, and I'm looking at this chart about primary care task distribution, where it talks about nurses and medical assistants perhaps not being utilized fully. And it sounds like there's a technology, attempt to look at technology is helping that along. How much do we think that's also, how do I put this? Certain level of professional unease with allowing folks that maybe different skill sets to do certain things. Well, I'm just wondering, I'm like, if we look at the technology, is there going to be enough confidence in from the MDs and the PAs to say that trust in that technology? I'm just wondering if that got addressed. It's more than just a information issue, it's a how you deliver healthcare.
I absolutely, and I think the point is that this is about putting it into a situation where the doctor, nurse practitioner, RN, CNA, they know the capacity and the capabilities of the system, and we're just going to take this program and plug it into your office and you guys go figure it out. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's a train-up period that would be expected, I would assume, because you're talking about working in a team. And today, any electronic health record, any system you put into a clinic, there's a train-up period. And so I think there are checks and balances in this. In fact, I know there are checks and balances in the system to preclude a doctor from making a diagnosis that may be inappropriate based on the information they get. But I don't think it gets you to the point where the physician or the nurse practitioner is going to make a differential diagnosis that is solely based on what the computer tells them. But it helps them. It moves them along that process. Because there is, every time you see a patient, there is a period of time where you have to get a history. Mm-hmm. You have to get a history of prison illness. And you kind of move yourself along the continuum until you get to the point where you're making this diagnosis. All we're trying to do is speed that process along so you're closer to that point of making the diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. And one of the questions will be,
Does it work?
I mean, how comfortable they feel.
Well, and I think that's a really interesting question, having watched, my mom was in the ER, and we saw seven people asking the exact same questions. And I was trying to understand if they either didn't have the information or it was a methodology of, we'll just keep asking it five different ways to see if we get a different answer. Because maybe we don't feel like we're getting the right answer. It was really interesting to watch.
And this is not emergency room. This is primary care.
Okay.
And so the stress level, you know, you're talking about a different technical situation.
That's true. Well, it sounds really interesting. Yeah. What are they asking for money-wise to do that?
Nothing.
Yeah, it turns out they're not asking for anything.
It's strictly the waiver.
Except asking.
Now, had we given them money, they would have accepted it. Right. But
yeah, it's simply to allow. It isn't even to force. It's to allow DHS to ask for the waiver. DHS is very supportive.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Well, it's money in the sense that if we're allowed to reimburse, it takes away the disincentive financially to try this if they can get the reimbursement, for example.
Absolutely.
Right. So,
Mr. Chair, would you like a motion?
I'd like a motion from Representative Mao.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would like to make a motion that we accept the -1 amendments to House Bill 2946.
Is there any discussion on the -1 amendment? Is there any objection? -1 amendments to 2946 are adopted.
And Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2946, as amended, be adopted with the due pass recommendation.
We moved and. Oh, wait a minute. Hold on. Here's the problem with this. Let's stand in this for a moment. We've asked for the ways and means waiver, the ways and means referral to be rescinded. We have two choices. We can send it forward with a request to rescind the waiver, at which point the speaker either will or won't rescind it, and if the speaker doesn't, it goes to ways and means, or we could hold it and see whether we can get it rescinded in advance. And Sandy, do you have any advice for us on this one?
Sir, it's just an administrative, you know, choice of the committee. With rescinding, if the rescinding request is denied by the speaker, what will happen is sometimes they will make the committee come back and reconsider that motion and make a formal motion to refer to ways and means anyway, or sometimes they will accept the motion and grant permission. So I'm not able to give you a clear-cut answer to that. It's the risk that the full committee chooses to take at this juncture.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Excuse me, I'm curious about the referral to Ways and Means. If there's no cost factor applied to it, was it because of it had an element?
The original bill.
In the original bill.
The original bill had a subsequent referral because there was a funding, it was requesting funding from general fund. The amendment has taken that language out.
Got it.
And so with that, I've asked the Speaker's office with the amendment, you know, that the committee would like to have the Ways and Means rescinded. I have not gotten permission from the Speaker's office.
That was my
fault,
if the request
has
been
made. Let's
hold it
then. You withdraw the motion. We'll hold it till a week from now and see if we can get it rescinded. I feel more comfortable doing that. I think I can make a clearer argument before it.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I withdraw my motion.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Has, with the dash one, I think it's a minimal fiscal, but this would require the department to... The
department says there's no fiscal.
They're saying no fiscal. It's a draft letter to CMS. They're fine. Okay.
Yeah, it isn't even a minimal. They're saying there's no fiscal.
Okay.
Let's, Sandy, if you'll help me work on that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's close the work session on 2946. Put it on next Friday's agenda, and I'll work hard to have the subsequent referral rescinded at that point. All right.
Thank you, Representative Maurer. Very interesting bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3000, and I'd like Representative Hovey, who's just lurking in the hallway, to come in and tell us where we are with this bill. For those of you that, this was a policy, was it, Tina?
Mm-hmm.
A certain policy?
Oh, no, we didn't.
We all had it.
In full. Oh, good.
Wasn't it?
In full last week. Representative Hovey, can you come and talk to us about where you see this bill is at the moment?
Where do I see it?
Yes. Right now it is, we have opened a work session for the purpose of
Well, Mr. Chair, State Representative Paul Holby, for the record, looking for my glasses for the record as well. The bill is in your committee in work session, and I think that there is a case for a public health hazard that's looming out there, that especially in the southern Willamette Valley, that. The plumes from the smoke of field burning put a lot of people at risk with their health care, and I think the risk is much greater, much more severe than the state of Oregon has recognized. And I think I've tried to demonstrate that with testimony and with documentation on the effects of fine particulates and the amount of pollution that's produced in the form of toxics, fine particulates from field burning. I mean, I just look back at in 4 days of burning, we produced more than 770 tons of fine particulates, 4,885 tons of carbon monoxide, more than 676 tons of toxic chemicals. that I previously described, like Ben being one, and I won't pronounce the one, but Ben Sanders last one. So, and the problem with all of that is our smoke management plan is best they try, and they do a good job of trying to direct these plumes away from urban areas. It is not an exact science. As a matter of fact, I think we provided testimony would tell you it's really a guess at best. And those plumes end up affecting some people. They go up and they go sideways. They go up and then they come back down and they settle on usually some of our rural communities. And those people are at extreme risk. And quite, you know, the measurement of the amount of toxics, the measurement of the fine particulates in those rural communities is not documented. We don't really, it's left up to chance what happens to those people that live in those areas that end up in those smoke areas. And you know, we all of our data, the 2% of the air particulate pollution involves coarse particulates, which is the vast amount of particulate air pollution is made up of coarse particulates. That's not the health risk. The health risk is the fine particulates. And so that kind of gives people a false sense of security that there's not really a lot of danger from these field burns. And, you know, I think that we look at even at best, when we measure fine particulates, they're using 24-hour averages, and the 1-hour average is, or even a 2-hour averages, are 8 times higher of fine particulates when it comes to how many micrograms per cubic meter are in there. And the EPA own advisory committee on their national ambient air quality standards has recommended that they move down from the 24-hour average scenario down to a 3-hour average, and the EPA has not adopted that standard, and nor has Oregon in the Department of Environmental Quality, which they could do if they chose to. This information is available to our state. It's available to the scientific community. The medical community knows this. Field burning has been stopped, and agricultural field burning has been stopped in the state of Idaho. In the state of Washington, grass seed burning has been stopped, and yet their yield and production goes up. You know, I feel this is unnecessary for us to continue this practice and putting so many lives at risk, sending people to the hospital, to the doctor's office, and burdening them with the cost of increased medication. You know, I just think that it's pretty evident that, you know, we need to be thinking about this issue. It's harming a lot of families in the southern end of the Willamette Valley especially. And quite frankly, if anybody was in the path of a field burning plume, no matter where it was, their health could be at risk. And it's just not a runny nose, and it's not just somebody with asthma. It increases risk of cardiac events and a lot of other medical conditions that are exacerbated to the extent that it has actually been documented to kill people. And I think it's time for the state of Oregon to take a step. I think the farming community, the Oregon State University, we have the science even from some of their own documentation to figure out another way to accomplish their goals without putting them out of business, without being a great burden to that industry. And, you know, frankly, it hurts our lifestyle, it hurts our tourism economy, it hurts a lot of other aspects of life in Oregon.
We're, as I understand the current circumstances, the extent to which we accept the power of the health testimony, I was personally at least very impressed with it. The only options we have now are to vote the bill with a due pass recommendation to the floor and with a subsequent referral to Ag and Natural Resources. Do we have any other options at the moment?
No, besides
not doing that.
Well, I mean, I guess we could not vote it out at all and sit in this committee and wait for some other news from the Speaker's office, I suppose, whether or not...
What's your pleasure?
Well, I think that it does need to be voted out and go to agriculture. I think the agriculture committee deserves to hear this same testimony, whether they choose to listen to the health care risk involved and talk about the emissions and talk about the agricultural alternatives. I guess that remains to be seen, and I will make that case to them. And I don't know that I have a lot of other choices, quite frankly, Chair Greenock. And I'm willing to take it over there and make my case there. And I would hope that I got the support from this committee to help me make that case for health care, because I think in this particular instance, I'm going to work on trying to work with the farming community and trying to deal with this problem, but this problem is so severe that and unrecognized, I think, in our community, in this building, in this legislature, in this government, I don't think that they've recognized the extreme impacts that this practice has because of the concentration and the short-term exposure, which we don't really measure and don't really account for in our data. I just go back. We do not breathe 24-hour averages, quite simply.
We hope we do.
It would be nice.
In short spurts.
But I think I provided a lot of people that really tell you that they don't. So.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I
think it turns out you're third in line.
Oh.
Is it in Bruin?
Is it muscle separate?
Or is it together?
Mr. Chair, you laid out what our options are in the full health care committee, and I suggest the way you phrased the option, which is that we send this out of here with a due pass recommendation to the Ag and Natural Resources Committee, and may I suggest that we also consider passing this out of here with no recommendation.
Yeah, what I said was, if we accept the testimony on the health effects, the only way we have to recognize or to basically report that we accept the notion that there are health effects that matter would be to send it with a due pass recommendation. I would say if we send it without any recommendation, it's a no comment on the health effects. At least that's sort of the way I would see it.
If I could just follow up, I hear what you're saying. I don't agree with that. I think if we have no comment, I was told by the health-oriented testimony as well. But I think in my mind there's a lot of unanswered questions with this that we've seen some of the broad healthcare potential healthcare implications, which I appreciate. But to me, this is a egg bill. For a lot of reasons, and I feel much more comfortable with their expertise than mine on the overall bill. And I don't think it's me saying no to it to any movement is saying I don't hear the healthcare implications. But I think when we do pass it over there with a due pass recommendation, that's got a lot of weight behind it. But it's not addressing the full bill.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it will. We limited our testimony to health effects. We specifically limited. So any comment, the due pass or the not due pass, is only about health effects. They obviously have the full bill, and they will deal with the full bill, whatever we say.
One more follow-up, and I hear what you're saying. I know I'm not going to convince you otherwise, but we had similar testimony to, what's in two committees that I've served on, both with Representative Gelser as well, we had a similar line of argument when it came to the Healthy Kids Plan, and that there was a policy component and then there was a funding component, and specifically this conversation came up both here and in the Revenue Committees on the opposite sides, and it's like, well, no, we only really need to address the whatever side we're looking at. And in that particular example here, we were only looking at the healthcare side and revenue. We were only looking at the revenue side, and it was very difficult for me to separate the two. It's a holistic bill. This is a holistic bill, or the issues that are embodied in this bill are holistic, and so it's hard for me to be intellectually honest and cut it in half and separate it out. So, for the record,
President Cote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'll be very honest. When we started off on the testimony, wherever that was, I was leaning towards a no recommendation. I was, you know, skeptical about the health issue, to be very honest, coming from someone who loves public health. But I went, you know, I went through all the information, and I've really had an about-face on this. I do think this is a public health issue. I read through all the material, and I think what was most convincing for me, and I understand the idea that we don't feel burn every day, it doesn't affect someone every day, I think it's the lodging of the particulate matter in the body that I don't think we are being very, we have to be very careful about that. 10 years ago, I think we would have been having a different conversation. We have a whole brand new set of research around the health effects of fine particulates lodging in the body. And I was trying to think of an analogy. I was kind of thinking of it about lead poisoning. You know, you get a little bit of lead poisoning, not a problem. You get a little more, it's more of a problem. I kind of, that's how I was viewing the information I was reading about fine particulates. Radiation, the buildup in the body. I think we're seeing that in the asthma rates, reading the information from Washington, Idaho. The unfortunate thing is we know this builds up in the body in a way that has long-term health effects. And so I do think it's a public health issue. I think we should pass it out with a due pass recommendation.
Is that a motion?
Almost. I don't think I can make a motion after a comment, but
okay.
I can. But I also think it's an economic issue. I do think it has to be reviewed by the Agricultural Committee. And the way I look at it is if we are asking the farmers, whoever, who use this practice to essentially take one for the team, because I think there's change over time. We know a lot more now about why this is dangerous. We're also asking an industry to change practice. Can we put some resources to do that? Because ultimately, I think this is better for everybody in the surrounding communities. This is going to improve the health. We're going to save money. Short term is going to be an impact on the folks who are doing it. And so I do think it's a public health issue. I would urge us to move it out of committee to ag with a due pass recommendation.
Is that a motion?
It is a motion.
Good. Okay. A motion on the floor. Let me just announce in the time frame, we have received the approval of the speaker to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means on the earlier bill, so we do want to make enough time to get that bill moving. Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an issue that's pretty significant in my district. I represent Corvallis and Philomath, and we do experience a fair amount of field burning there. When I first moved to Corvallis in the early 90s, I thought it was rather odd. It was field burning season, and you know, we came into town and people were wearing surgical masks, and I wondered if there was an outbreak in the community, but it was burning time and allergy time and all of those other things. Last year, during field burning time, we had a field burn that went quite badly, and my phone rang off the hook with individuals complaining about their trips to the emergency room and the problems that they had when the wind shifted and blew all of the smoke into the residential areas. This has been a fairly high-volume issue for me in my office from people who have firsthand experience with the poor health effects of this. Likewise, I've had a fair amount of communication from Oregon State University and School of Ag, which is also in my legislative district, with concerns about the impact on the farmers. However, given that this is the health committee, I really do believe this is a significant health concern for the people in my district. And I haven't had any communication from anyone that says it's not a health concern. So I will support the motion with the request that the Ag Committee really look very carefully at the scope of the bill. I've had, in particular, some concern about the impact on Christmas tree farmers and whether or not there's a difference in the burning of Christmas trees as opposed to burning grass seed. And I hope that those are some of the kinds of things that will be looked at the Agricultural Committee to make sure that we are getting the maximum health benefits with the minimal negative impact on the agricultural community and pulling out parts that might not be as necessary, which I'm not sure about because that's not my area of expertise and not what we had testimony on.
Representative Maurer?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think it's difficult to make a causal relationship between field burning and long-term health effects. I mean, it's clear that you can have some short-term consequences. That's the doubt. But, I mean, if the small particulate matter is an issue, then I think field burning is the least of our concerns. And we have auto emissions, we have a ton of other things that are a more significant long-term issue. And so that's I will be voting no if it is with the due pass recommendation. I'll be voting no on this vote.
Representative Cannon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am convinced that there are significant health risks. And I'll be supporting this recommendation because it was also clear to me in conversation, not here, but in my office with representatives of the industry, that there may be an opportunity for some sort of severe limitation of this practice, perhaps not the complete ban of it in Oregon, but that the industry would not necessarily suffer from some quite significant limitation of burning above and beyond the limitations they're already under. So I think this is an opportunity to send a strong message to the Agriculture Committee that they should pursue that line. So that'll be my vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be brief. I also support referring this with the DUPAS recommendation. I must express my frustration in the prior hearing about not being able to ask the questions that I wanted to ask because they weren't related to the health issues. And although the my district is all in Washington County and we don't really get the effects of it, I lived in Lane County and in Eugene for several years, so I have absolutely no doubt that it does affect a lot of people and the health of a lot of people. And so I do support that, and I also encourage that the Agriculture Committee look at the information that we did receive about the adjacent states that have either completely banned or almost totally banned field burning and the effect on the industry there, because I believe I read somewhere that it has not negatively affected the industry. Thank you.
I'm sure Representative Roblin would be happy to have you sit in if you have time for that, at least for some of those.
I wish I did.
Yeah, I know. It's a big problem. Yes. Representative Flores?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And since you are asking for a vote with whether or not a due pass recommendation, I'm just explain to you the reason I will be voting no. I looked at some of the information that we wanted to kind of rush through, and I know Representative Holby did have some counter-argument that when we looked at the National Air Ambient Air Quality Standards, and when we talked about due to lack of evidence linking health problems to long-term exposure to coarse particle pollution, the agency revoked the annual PM sub 10 standard in 2006. Then we look at the letter from to Representative Holby from an air quality planning manager, talked about field burning emissions representing 2% of total particulate emissions in the valley during this time period. And because field burning emissions reflect short-term seasonal activity, they represent less than 1% of the total amount of particulate emissions, and it goes on. Then if you looked at the information regarding correlation to asthmatic hospitalizations and others, and once again, I respect your counter-argument that I recall you having brought up during that time period, Representative Holby. But I think that we saw a lower hospitalization for asthma patients in the prime field burning time than we saw in the earlier part of the year. And same with the grass seed burning. So I will be a no looking at a lot of that information as well.
Thank you, Representative Flores. I think we've all had a chance to comment.
Mm-hmm.
There's a motion on the floor to move HB 3000 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to the House Agricultural and Natural Resources Committee. Mary, will you please call the roll?
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
No.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
No.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
No.
Vice Chair Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Breaks the pattern. Excuse.
Chair Greenman.
Aye. HB 3000 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to House Agricultural and Natural Resources. I apologize to all of you, including the sponsor, the fact that I don't think we really gave enough time even to the health effects. It was just so interesting. Both sides of it, but we should have a lot more time.
Mr. Chair, if I may comment, I do appreciate what you've done for passing this bill, hearing this bill. I wish we had more time to talk and debate more of the fine particulates or points of this bill. And I do intend on working with the agriculture community and the agriculture committee to try to look into some of the other issues and be a little bit more reasonable about an overall statewide total ban and look at how we can work towards solving this problem for a great many people that suffer from the smell. Thank you.
Start by having a beer with some of the representatives sitting in the back row.
He has to buy.
That's right. Sorry, he has to buy. He's willing to.
Scared, I'm scared where it'll take me.
Close the work session at HB 3000 and open a work session on HB 2946.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2946, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the Ways and Means referral be rescinded.
Exactly.
Thanks for the keys.
Is there any discussion? Aaron, would you please call the roll?
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Gelson.
Aye.
Representative Mallon.
Aye.
Vice Chair Clinton.
Aye.
Vice Chair.
Excused. Aye. Motion passes. Would you like to carry it to the floor?
Sure, I'd be honored.
HB 2946 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The subsequent referral of the Ways and Means rescinded, and Representative Maurer will carry it. We're out almost on time. Have a great weekend. Drive carefully. And the House